This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in to KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio, and this is Radioactive Magazine. I'm Mike Nichols, and in today's show, we're going to do highlights from David Cobb's barnstorming tour stop here in Kansas City, which was happened last Tuesday. That'd be April 22nd, I believe, over at UMKC at the Pearson Auditorium. David Cobb is one of the founding members of Move to Amend, a group that is working towards abolishing corporate personhood and getting rid of the idea or the legalness of money being free speech. So I had the great opportunity to go see it and had a great time. I shouldn't say a great time, but and that's not exactly what I mean. But just want to say that he was a great speaker, very inspiring, very insightful. I was very glad to make it and be able to meet with him and see what he had to say. And for those of you who weren't able to make it, I did recordings. This was about a two-hour event, so this is very condensed down, but I'm hoping that I've in the half-an-hour show that I can at least get the meat of what he was talking about. So without any further delay, let's start with the first clip. This is David Cobb talking last week, and this is from his 2014 barnstorming tour stop here in Kansas City.
I'm going to tell a story on how it came to be that these large transnational corporations are not just exercising power today. I'm going to tell a story on how it came to be that large transnational corporations are ruling us. As surely as masters once ruled slaves, as surely as kings once ruled subjects, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are ruling over us because they're making the decisions. Corporate CEOs already decided what your transportation choices were going to be to get to this meeting. Corporate CEOs are deciding what kind of health care you'll get. Doesn't matter what you need, corporate insurance CEOs decide whether you get it or not. Corporate CEOs are controlling the energy policy of this country. Corporate CEOs are determining how much poison will be in the water that we're drinking and the air that we're breathing. Corporate CEOs decided to take this country into war. And we, the people, we get to choose between Coke or Pepsi. We can choose between paper or plastic at a grocery store line. See, we're given all sorts of consumer choices, provided you have the money to pay. That's sort of important because in our society, if you don't have the money to buy it, it doesn't matter what your needs are. But even deeper than that, I'm going to challenge you to recognize this, that no matter how wonderful a consumer choice is, it is not political power. See, political power would be the opportunity to participate in a meaningful way with the decisions that affect our lives. You know, things like the XL pipeline that is actually going to clearly impact our lives. The question about whether Social Security will be slashed. You know, the kinds of things that really matter to us on the day-to-day, I submit this to you. We have very few opportunities for meaningful participation to actually influence those things, right? And so consumer choices are fine, but let's just be very clear. It's not the same thing as robust political power. Now, I want to be clear. I vote, right? I've run for office. I vote. I believe in voting. But if you want systemic change and all you ever do is go and pull a lever every 2 to 4 years, you're wasting your time. Right? If you want systemic change, we've got to vote and get involved in organizations that are actually helping to collectivize power and to actually make demands. Right? So I'm going to tell a story today. And as I tell this story, I want to challenge you to challenge me to make sure and ask yourself, is this a story that only political progressives can hear and understand? Or has Move to Amend figured out a way to tell a story that will cut across political ideologies, cut across party affiliations and labels, and actually unite us around a shared analysis of how our democratic republic is supposed to operate? And as I tell this story, we're going to cover four topics together. The first topic is the word democracy. That word gets tossed around a lot in the United States, so let's make sure we've got some common ground. From what language does the word democracy derive?
Greek.
Greek, very good. Demos means the people. Kratia means, anybody know? Rule. Literally, translated from the Attic Greek, the word democracy means the people rule. Pop quiz. How many of y'all believe we the people are ruling in the United States? Don't be shy. Look around. We got one hand in the air. I do this presentation all across the country. I did it 150 times last year. I ask this question everywhere I go. Almost nobody raises their hands. That's a problem. Saying it another way, I would say it's a good thing. What? No. It's not a good thing that the people don't rule. I think it's a good thing that people aren't raising their hands to that question. I think it's a good thing that we're being courageous enough to confront a scary reality. That notwithstanding what we were taught in this country, notwithstanding what we want in this country, we the people don't actually rule. We don't actually have a functioning democracy in the United States of America. In fact, if we were to stay with the Attic Greek, we'd have to admit, we don't have a democracy, we have a plutocracy. The rule by a small wealthy elite. In fact, if we were really going to be honest, we'd have to make up another word, a kleptocracy. The rule by a thieving small wealthy elite. So when people tell us, oh, you can't amend the Constitution, it moved to amend, that's too hard. We can't do that. I think, have you not been paying attention? Throughout all of world history, throughout all of U.S. history, profound changes have been made. And I don't just mean changes in one administration or another. I don't even mean one political party or another. I mean changes in social institutions, changes in power dynamics, changes in our culture and how our society is organized have been made. And now, my friends, the text is going to get metaphysical on y'all, so get ready. We are all individually participating in creating our shared collective reality. Another way to say it is, if enough people think that something is true, if enough people act like it's true, it will become true. And so here's the thing, folks. If it is true that the United States of America is fundamentally racist, sexist, and class oppressive, and that is true. And if it is true that the huge transnational corporations are destroying the planet that we depend upon for life itself, and that is true, then I suggest to you that we ought to be thinking and acting differently. Maybe we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a crisis. You know why I think we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a crisis? Because we're in a crisis. I mean, literally, we're in a crisis right now, and most of you know it. And here is the thing. We know we're in this crisis, but the ruling elite and the people who are really in charge of this society constantly suppress that knowledge and, even worse, work to convince us not to articulate out loud what we know to be true. We know we're in a crisis. In fact, let's name it. It's an ecological crisis that's happening across the globe. It's an economic crisis. It's a social justice crisis. In fact, it's a series of crises that are cascading down around our ears. And I say that because I think it's important to tell the truth so we can have some clarity about what's really going on so that we can make smart, intelligent decisions about what to do as engaged citizens. The other thing I want to say is don't get too upset, because remember that in the Chinese language, where they use symbols for words, the symbol for the word crisis is also the symbol for another word.
Opportunity.
Opportunity. Folks, we are in a crisis moment that is both opportunity, danger at the same time. And let's just tell the truth that this crisis is a crisis of the implosion of an empire. And as I say that, let's just acknowledge something that we know from world history. All empires fall. That's a truism. And what's interesting is we study world history, we see every empire has fallen because of imperial overshoot. That is, that the empire goes out, sucks up the natural resources from the surrounding area so badly, so profusely, that it implodes. And in past times in human history, the survivors of that empire would simply meld into the savanna or the forest or the jungle or whatever the ecology was around them, right? What we have to come to terms with, for the first time in human civilization, this is a global empire. There's no place to go. So I submit to you that our challenge, our duty, our responsibility in this generation is to learn to intelligently, intentionally, deliberately dismantle empire and dismantle the institutions that are fundamentally unsustainable and are exploitive and oppressive, and create new institutions that are sustainable and that are premised upon and facilitate love and compassion and sharing. And you know what? We know those are actually core human values, love, compassion, and sharing. Why don't we hear that talked about in elections or amongst politicians? When's the last time we heard somebody really willing to stand up and say, we need to be a more loving and compassionate society, and we need to have policies that help to facilitate the best instincts of human beings, right? And this idea of dismantling empire and recreating institutions, it really is just that simple and just that hard. But that's the challenge for us.
And for those of you who are just tuning in, this is Radioactive Magazine on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio. I'm Mike Nichols, and we are, in today's episode, doing the highlights of founding member of Move to Amend Men's, David Cobb, and his barnstorming tour stop here in Kansas City, which was last Tuesday over at UMKC at Pearson Auditorium. So without any further delays, let's go back on to the next clip.
Legal personhood. My friends, please note that I did not write the word corporate personhood on the board. That's because legal personhood means the ability to assert rights. And since I'm talking about legal personhood, I mean the ability to assert rights under law. And saying it that way, I hope it's obvious that this is not a technicality. This is not something that only lawyers should concern themselves with. The question of who is a legal person and who can assert rights under law has been at the core of every social movement in this country, from the American Revolution itself to the women's suffrage movement to the abolitionist movement to the civil rights movement. The question of who is a legal person matters, and it matters a great deal. And the last topic on the board is the word corporation. From what language does the word corporation derive? Latin, very good. Let's break it down. Corpus means body, and the suffix T-I-O-N means to have or create, or the inherent quality of. So literally, the word corporation translated means to have or create body. And by body in this case, I mean physical body. That's because in law school we are taught... By the way, are there any lawyers in the crowd besides me that would admit it? All right, here we got two right here that would raise their hand. So two men, I think. So my brother's at the bar. Do you remember being taught this in law school, that a corporation is a legal fiction? Yeah. Of course, right? Every lawyer I ask knows that. Watch this. Even if you weren't subjected to 3 years of the law school experience, if you've heard that phrase, even if you couldn't precisely define it, if you've heard that a corporation is a legal fiction, raise your hand. For real. But half of the hands, more than half the hands go up. Corporation is legal fiction. Corporation is legal fiction. A corporation is a legal fiction. So if a corporation is a legal fiction, that begs the question, what does the word fiction mean?
Not true.
Made up. Literally. In law school, my corporations professor on day one stood before us and said, you must understand that a corporation does not exist in the material physical world. You know, reality. It doesn't actually exist, the professor told us, but we will pretend like this group of people and the material and resources that they have assembled and the contractual obligations that they make and the cultural assumptions, a very rich, complex abstraction, we're going to pretend like it's a physical one thing under law. so that we can treat it a certain way under law. And remember, if enough people think that something is true, if enough people act like it's true,
it becomes true.
A corporation is an abstraction, but it is constructed because we socially give it meaning and reality, and then the legal system and our social institutions act accordingly. Folks, I hope you understand the Move to Amend Coalition is not anti-corporation. That would be foolish. There are very many important good uses of corporations. It's really a very important way to help to assemble like resources and allocations, right? A corporation is a tool and nothing more.
And just for brevity's sake, because we have a short amount of time to do, David Cobb goes on to talk about the good things that corporations do, and kind of talks about the history of corporations and how corporations needed to be for the public good, and talking about things like hospitals and the aqueduct system and like back in Rome, and how in the very early parts of the creation of corporations that it was something where a way to get people together to work on big tasks and to make good things happen. Like I said, for brevity's sake, I had to cut that part. And now we're going to go on to kind of what we're running in today with the modern-day multinational corporations, the ones that are really causing the problems right now. So here we go to the next clip.
The modern transnational corporation actually comes out of the 14th and 15th century of Europe. You know, the age of discovery. I had to put discovery in my imaginary quotation marks because, after all, what did the Europeans discover in the 14th and 15th century? Well, Africa, Asia, later North and South America.
How to exploit nature.
Newsflash, right. There were people living there. They were not lost. They weren't discovered. And so, in the same spirit of truth-telling and courageous honesty that we exhibited earlier, let's just tell the truth. The 14th and 15th century wasn't the age of discovery at all. It was the age of rape and pillage and plunder and murder. There's one word that sums that up for me, and that's empire. See, that's what imperialism means. And this is important. Stay with me, because the modern transnational corporation, as we would understand it, was actually created during the era of the modern European empire, and it was done intentionally and deliberately. The point is, they were called joint stock companies, and the joint stock companies were created as a construct as intentional, deliberate imperial tools. For example, one of the most famous of those joint stock companies was the East India Company. Ah, you've heard of it. Literally designed to militarily conquer the entire subcontinent of India. But not only that, to destroy their civilization and to force those people to work and labor to steal the resources from their own land so that those resources could be sent as well to the shareholders of the East India Company as profit. It was a business model based on imperialism. I'm going to make it an American story by asking this question. How many colonies in the founding of the United States of America?
13.
Everybody knows that. How many colonies in the founding of the United States?
13.
So since you all knew that and it was so easy, I'm going to ask the follow-up question. Of those 13 colonies, how many of them were corporations? Doggone it, that was supposed to be a trick question. But this is a very politically astute crowd. The answer, all of them. Now, I want to get back to this story, though, because in this story, I'm going to be the king, and I'm going to create Massachusetts. But listen, folks, I'm not going to bother with administering Massachusetts on the day-to-day. I'm the king. I've got other people to exploit. So instead, I'm going to create an office known as the Royal Governor. And now, friends, I'm going to actually quote from the original charter that created Massachusetts. I, the king, create Massachusetts. Create a legal position and title known as the Royal Governor. And then task the royal governor with the legal responsibility, quote, and this is an actual quote, quote, to plant, to rule, and to govern this new area on behalf of me, the king, to benefit me, the king, but also to benefit the other shareholders of the joint stock company known as the Massachusetts Bay Trading Company. See, Massachusetts began as a for-profit corporation on the same business model as the East India Company. So, too, Virginia began as the Virginia Company. Georgia was a penal corporation that, in contemporary terms, we would not call the person administering this corporation a royal governor. What would we call that person? A CEO. My friends, the American revolutionaries were not calling for a more socially responsible king. The American revolutionaries were not calling for a more socially responsible CEO. Perhaps today we could raise our aspirations a little higher. Maybe we should remember that our historic legacy, we come from revolutionaries. That's actually what the American Revolution was, right? I mean, it's a very important and profound way to think about it. And I'm going to go further. The American Revolution was not merely a rejection of monarchy as a form of rule. Now that we understand this history, can't we see the American Revolution was also a people's uprising against illegitimate corporate rule? That's our historic legacy. And although I said the American revolutionaries were not more calling for a more socially responsible king, I think it's super important to recognize that just 10 years before the revolution actually erupted, those people who would become revolutionaries, just 10 years before, most of them were writing letters to the king that went something like this. Oh, Father King, we, your humble and obedient children, come before you on bended knee to beg that you intervene on our behalf because your royal governor is administering unfair rules. Unfair business and trade rules, by the way. It wasn't just taxation without representation. The complaints were against the Stamp Act, the Navigation Act, the Intolerable Acts. All international trade and business rules. They said, King, the English Parliament are passing unfair, unjust, illegitimate rules that are favoring the East India Company Joint Stock Company Corporation over us. And we're subjects, we're human English subjects. Up to you, pop quiz. What percentage of the English Parliament passing these laws do you think owned shares in the East India Company? 100%. See how important it is that we actually ask these kinds of questions? And they begged, Father King, would you please intervene on our behalf? It was the most sniveling, groveling language you can imagine. And I don't know about you, but I'm keenly interested in trying to understand what happened in that 10 years. What happened to a group of people so that they started to change how they thought? They started to change how they acted. What stories did they start to tell each other that convinced them to stop the boot kissing? To stop the groveling and the begging before the king and instead to stand up and to stand up straight and put their shoulders back, put their chin up, look directly at the king, you know, the king who claimed cultural authority from God, and behind the king see the most powerful military empire the world had ever assembled to that point of time and say, you're done, get out, we're going to do it different. Because let me tell you something, folks, the process I just described, that process is magic. And if just one person stands up against injustice and oppression, that's a courageous act that needs to be applauded and acknowledged. And at this point, yeah, you can applaud courageous acts.
And that was, for me, that was really interesting to kind of listen to him talk about, you know, the history of our country and talking about like the 13 colonies and as they're starting as corporations and us standing up to corporate rule. As sort of the beginning of the country, it's like I never really thought about the founding of our country in those terms, and it just made, really puts into perspective what we're going through now. And we don't need to listen to me talk. I want to get all of the David Cobb clips in that I got here. So we're going to jump right into the next one. Here we go.
Back to my story, because remember, we're talking about the American revolutionaries and the American Revolution. The revolutionaries won. Yay that. So a new charter gets written. This new charter is going to describe how the political and legal system operates. The supreme law of the land. What's that charter called? The U.S. Constitution. How many of you have read the Constitution? Oh, good. A lot of hands go up. Y'all grade my papers. See if I get this right. I'll tell you, when you read the Constitution in its entirety, you'll see two actors. The first actor is the most important actor. In fact, it's so important, it's the first three words.
We the people.
Those are hallowed words in this country, and they should be. See, we the people come together to create the second actor, which is government itself. Saying it this way, I hope it's clear, we the people create government. Government is dependent upon us. In fact, we the people are understood and described to be free and sovereign. What does the word sovereign mean again? The authority to rule. The king isn't sovereign. We kicked his butt out. But check it out. Government isn't sovereign either. Government doesn't have the authority to rule over us. In this framework, government is subordinate and accountable. Government is subordinate to whom? The people. Government is accountable to whom? The people. That's got a ring to it, doesn't it? I like how this is going. Let's continue. We the people are free and sovereign because we the people have rights. Government does not have rights. Government only has duties. And the difference between rights and duties is profound. If I have the right to do something, it means I can do it. And I don't need anybody's permission. Legally. Culturally, if mama ain't happy, nobody's happy. And it's a joke, but it's also important because, see, that's a cultural reality, right? And isn't it interesting that in this society, somehow, the cultural values that we hold around love and compassion and sharing and sustainability, our legal system is completely divorced from that. Our legal, political, and economic systems are actually facilitating the exact opposite of the values that we hold. That's a problem. And duties are legal responsibilities, right? And so government never has rights over the people. In fact, government can't infringe upon my rights. If government writes a law at the local, state, or federal level that infringes upon my rights, or your rights, or Leon, your rights, or anybody's rights, government's wrong, not us. It's an illegitimate exercise of governmental power. And government never has rights. Government only has duties. And where do governmental duties come from? All power resides with the people. The point I'm making is, in our framework of government, the people do hold all the political power, but we wisely delegate a certain amount of our power to government. Do we delegate all our power to government? Hell no! We only delegate enough power for government to perform the duties that we have told them to do. And that, my friends, is what limited government means. Government is limited in its power to perform the duties that we, the people, have told them to do. And how does government discharge those duties or perform those duties? They write laws in the public interest. And at this point, I just want to stop for a moment and say, there's obviously going to be disagreement about what those public laws should be, right? And frankly, that's as it should be. There should be robust discourse and debate. One thing, as the government is discharging their duties, they cannot do is to write a public law that violates the private rights or the constitutional rights of anybody. And now that we've spent this time laying out this framework, watch this. In one sentence, I'm going to describe how our Constitution is supposed to operate. It's a run-on sentence, but it's still one sentence. Watch this. In the United States constitutional framework, we the people are free and sovereign because we hold all the political power in this country. But we wisely delegate a certain amount of our power to government. Government which we will always hold subordinate and accountable to we the people. And we will charge government with the specific duties to write laws in the public interest. And those laws at the local, state, and federal level are actually how public policy will operate. However, the one thing that no public law can ever legitimately do is to violate the private rights of the free and sovereign people who live there. Ta-da! I mean, really, isn't this brilliant? Isn't this beautiful? We should try that in this country. This would totally work. And I'm not joking, this is brilliant. But Howard Zinn said, here's one sentence. A series of struggles by actual human beings to be defined as persons with rights under our Constitution. See how important that is? A series of struggles by actual human beings to be defined as legal persons. That's our history. And now that we've lined up this incredible framework, it might behoove us to ask, where should a corporation go? When the U.S. Supreme Court, in an act of supreme judicial activism, by the way, says, we're going to tell you, actually five of us are going to tell 315 million of you that notwithstanding history, notwithstanding logic, notwithstanding prior understanding of how this whole political, economic, and legal system is supposed to operate, you must now treat a corporation as if it's a person with inherent and alienable constitutional rights. And that perverts this whole framework. See, corporate personhood is a shorthand for the idea that a corporation can claim to have the inherent and alienable rights of a living, breathing human being. And that's not just an illogical idea, which it is. It's not just a stupid idea, which it is. The idea of corporate personhood perverts our sacred right to self-government. And what pisses me off as a lawyer, they're using our legal system to legitimize the theft. And they're telling us that it's just the rule of law. You have to accept it. Well, I say, ya basta. Enough already. It's time for us to do what other people have done before us and to educate, to agitate, to build a mass movement that says we're going to change this country. We're going to change the story. We're going to change how our political, economic, and legal systems operate.
And that was David Cobb of Move to Amend. On his barnstorming tour, he came into Kansas City last Tuesday. And if you have, if you want to find out more about Move to Amend, you can go to movetoamend.org, or you can look for the Kansas City chapter. You can go on Facebook and do KC Move to Amend. So thank you for tuning in and listening to Radioactive Magazine. And stay tuned. Coming up next is Counterspin.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.